Hello, my name is Eileen Imperatrice, and I am 51 years old. Today is Friday, March 6th, 2020, and I am in Fresno, California. I'm talking with my husband, Tony Imperatrice, and we will start shortly.
I'm Tony Imperatrice. I'm 56, and my partner here is my wife, Eileen Imperatrice.
So today I was thinking about all the things that we've been through in the last few years, of course, and I think I've been thinking about that a lot lately.
Sure.
It's been a rough few years with a lot of health issues and both of us losing our mothers and all of that. So I have been contemplating quite a bit how we've survived these last few years so far. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I don't know. At this point, I'm just, after everything, I've just kind of fallen into a flow with it. You know, it is what it is.
So. I think you seem to feel more comfortable with that than I do at the moment, because I'm still currently going through my latest health crisis. And so I'm feeling still trying to adjust to the new normal of cancer and then trying to get through it. It was easier, I think, when we were going through the kidney transplant because, like I said before, I felt like there was a definite goal that we got to be able to do the transplant through UCSF. And everything that fell into place for that seemed to go so well. And I know, of course, you're still with the polycystic kidney disease, but at least you have a new kidney and it seems to be working really wonderfully. So I'm very grateful for that. And then, of course, even though I have only one kidney, I know that I'm doing well with kidneys anyway. That's the one thing that is working well. And so I think that's kind of where I am with my thoughts on our journey so far.
Well, the thing that comes to my mind is that I had more time to adjust to the new normal because I was diagnosed in 2002. So I've had, what's that, 18, 19 years
right.
To adjust to that. And in 2002, I knew that the transplant was inevitable, but that didn't happen until 2017. So I had, 15 years to adjust to how my life was never going to be the same and the fact that I would forever be living with a terminal disease that could only be treated. There was no cure for it.
Right. I think, and I agree with that, that it's probably that you had more time to adjust to that. And I think also because the way that everything fell into place with Kaiser Hospital helping us arrange all that and then going through UCSF and all the doctors and everybody that we met with, it seemed to be put together so smoothly that it never seemed like we were, oh my gosh, now we suddenly have to do this right away. It was the path and the process to do all that.
It was a slower walk. It was definitely a slower walk. And I also think that the diagnosis forced, the diagnosis in 2002 of polycystic kidney disease forced the issue of me facing up to my alcoholism and being in recovery and learning all of the tools and tactics for dealing with my addiction, because that's also permanent. It doesn't change.
Right.
I just have to live with it. And that gave me the opportunity to kind of, well, I guess what I want to say is that what I learned in recovery applied directly to what I would need to do to get through living with a terminal disease.
That's very fortunate that you had that groundwork already then. I never thought about it that way. And the thing is, I think in addition to just getting used to the new normal, it's also like what I've said before, it's the relinquishing of what we were before. That's been the hardest thing for me.
Yeah.
Because I was used to being the healthy person, and especially since I was able to be your donor, I felt like I was really living my purpose of being a healthy person, that I was so healthy that I could be a good donor and that I was able to do that. And then even after the surgery was over and the transplant, I was still healthy and everything was going well. And then all of a sudden now I have cancer. And it is a diagnosis that makes you feel like you've lost everything that you were before. I'm no longer the healthy person anymore. And I have this cloud over my head that the cancer might come back. Even as I get through this round, even if I get through this cancer diagnosis currently, you know, I still have that concern forever that I'm no longer just permanently healthy anymore. Even as much as I tried through my life to, you know, always exercise and eat well and everything, and I thought I was doing so well, and I was confirmed by UCSF when I was the perfect donor. I mean, they even said I was a super donor, meaning that I could donate to just about anybody, which is pretty rare. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. I felt so proud of the fact that I could do that. And then, boom, you have cancer. And now it's like rug was pulled out from under me.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think I dealt with that change, that sudden life change in 2002, both with the polycystic kidney diagnosis and the entering into alcoholism recovery, that the person I had been was actually the means of my own destruction, because the last music directorship I had, initially I blamed the failures of that on everybody else. And of course, in recovery, I learned that at the very least, I had a part in it. And when years later, I looked back on it, I realized that the person I had been was the person that was destroying me. And I had to face up to the fact that I had to leave that person behind, and it was in my own best interest to do so. And that was a big part of recovery, was that the old me, who thought he was the happy drunk life of the party guy, who was actually the raging asshole guy, and I had to face up to that. And so, you know, I left the old me behind in 2002.
Well, see, and that's where I feel like our situations are a little bit different, because I was doing everything, quote unquote, right. Mm-hmm. I was living right. I was eating healthy. I was exercising. I was being a good person and trying to, you know, be out in the world as a positive force and stuff. So I thought I was living the correct life. And I think that's what a lot of people deal with when they're handed a disease, that they're like, well, why did this happen? You know, if I'm doing the right things, why is this coming down on me? You know, and it's interesting the way you described then that yours was letting go of somebody that wasn't working for you, that wasn't a good thing. And so you were letting go of something that was not the best anyway to live a better life. Mm-hmm. Whereas for me, I felt like, well, I was already living a positive life, and now I'm still getting this horrible disease, and I still have to lose what I was before, even though it was a good thing. So that's what's really baffling, I think, for a lot of people when you're handed a disease that did not come from bad behavior or bad choices. Then you wonder, well, why?
Well, of course, you know, for me, the two big things, alcoholism and polycystic kidney, alcoholism was partly my choice, and I've come to understand that the reason I was an alcoholic was a combination of things, a predisposition to addiction, my screwed up childhood, and not to blame mom for everything, but all of those things had an impact on it. But at the end of the day, it came down to my choice to pick up the drink and go for that instant gratification. And for a long time, it worked. Polycystic kidney is a genetic disorder, so that wasn't by choice either.
Mm-hmm.
And on the little form we filled out at the beginning of this, I left the religion thing blank.
I almost thought about doing that too.
even though by profession I'm a church organist, and I've been a professional church minister for 40 years, the thing that I had to give up on, and I guess this is the long way around to my point about your quandary about you lived a good life, so why aren't you being rewarded?
I don't think I'm necessarily being rewarded. But
I believe me, I felt the same way when you got the cancer diagnosis. And I'm like, this is my kidney donor. You know, how dare you give her cancer? But, you know, the other understanding that I have chosen to give up on is I don't believe in puppet master God. I don't believe in I dream a genie God.
Mm-hmm.
And I have come to the conclusion that God is not a being or entity of any description, and God doesn't exist in a realm somewhere, that it's a little closer to maybe what the Eastern philosophies believe about God being a universal presence that is within us and around us.
Well, you know, and I almost... Oh, so go ahead.
That just, that's the only way I can, you know, because the Christian idea of this God entity, this white-haired old man on a throne just doesn't work. And for that very reason, because of the fact that that implies that somebody's in charge and somebody's making decisions and deciding you're going to get cancer and you're going to have an easy life and you're going to be rich and you're going to be poor. And the more I look at that, the more I think it's bullshit, that there's just no way that that can be the reality of God. But I still believe that there is a power greater than ourselves. And I believe that everything is as it needs to be from the grander perspective.
See, and that's now... And that's now a harder thing for me to understand because
right.
I think I kind of felt the same way. And it's funny, like I said, I almost didn't put religion down too, just because since I really kind of walked away from it quite a while ago. And that was more to do with the politics of behind the scenes, not necessarily that I didn't enjoy my religion. I mean, I certainly did. And I grew up definitely, you know, immediately into Catholicism.
You grew up uber Catholic.
Yeah, and, you know, and my family was very involved with the church, and I enjoyed that, you know, and I got very involved as well and did a lot of really fun things and had some really amazing experiences. But then as I got older, the people that were involved, I got to know more behind the scenes and thought, this is not what I want to be associated with. This is no longer the religion that I recognized as a child, even growing up. It became something so politicized and so, you know, power hungry and then all the other stuff that's going on in the Catholic Church that I don't agree with. And so it became a situation where I felt I needed to just walk away so that I could retain some sense of faith still separate from that. No longer the organized in the particular church religion, but just something that is still within me. Hmm. You know, and it's the thing I hold on to, I think, still today. But again, that bigger question of just... why? And I certainly never would say, and I've said this over and over again from the very beginning, I would never expect that I wouldn't get something. I'm going to have to die of something someday. I mean, obviously something is going to happen to me. But you don't ever expect cancer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the thing is that I'm not saying that I didn't expect that I might get cancer because my family definitely has it. Although my immediate family, nobody has it. It's my aunts and uncles, all from my mom's side of the family, that had cancer of some sort. So I actually thought maybe we were that little void in the center that it skips a generation and we don't get it. And since nobody else in my family immediately, my brothers and sisters or mother, father, ever got it, I thought, oh, okay, I should be good. And so it was just such a surprise and such a shock because I just wasn't expecting it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, like I say, it's not because I didn't think that I would ever get something or that I was somehow this great person immune to everything and would never deserve anything, you know, and it's, that's the thing is that I think I disagree with what you're saying is that I don't feel like I'm some amazing, special person that doesn't get the same thing everybody else does. I still get the flu. I still get colds. I still get everything else. So why wouldn't I get any other disease? It's just that you just never expect it. And so even though you know in your mind that you're not immune to anything, you don't expect it until it actually happens. And so when they finally said the words, you have cancer, I was like, oh my God, I never thought I would hear the words. And it's even the joke I made to you about how when I would drive by, because my doctor's office is not very far from the cancer center that I'm going to almost every day now. And every time I drive by, I just, boy, I hope I never have to go there. And then sure enough. And so, and yet, you know, going to that particular place, the doctors and nurses and everybody there have been wonderful.
Yeah,
They certainly have taken good care of me. I don't say anything negative about the place itself. It's just that I wish I didn't have to go there.
Yeah. I think we've had, you know, I guess if there's a flip side to any of this, with both the kidney transplant and now your cancer treatments, we've both had really good experiences. UCSF was amazing.
With the medical professionals, definitely.
And C-Care, the cancer treatment center here in Fresno, is phenomenal. And just the one thing that they do that nobody else does, they have a financial advocate that is on the phone dealing
that's
with our insurance
biggest
company. Hallelujah, amen. I mean,
because
that
was just one of those extra worries you don't want to have to think about when you're going through cancer. Right. It's like, gee, how am I going to pay for this? And especially as both self-employed individuals, because you're a musician and I'm an artist, there's not a regular paycheck.
Right.
We're having to, you know, we make enough money to be able to have a house and to do all the things that we need to do. But when things like this come around, you're just...
Well, plus we were wiped out from 2.5 years ago with the kidney transplant.
Exactly.
You know,
that took all of my savings, all my IRAs, everything to pay for that, plus all the fundraisers we had on top of it from our wonderful friends who helped us out. And so that was great. We were able to pay for everything, but now we had nothing for yet another medical crisis. And for me, it was, I know, and I appreciate that you're trying to be on top of those things, and I really appreciate that C-Care has that financial person to take care of those things, but it doesn't mean it leaves my mind.
No.
And so my first...
We still have to come up with the money.
My thoughts are like, oh, great, now I have another thing that's going to rob us of being able to even further our careers, because now not only the fact that I'm going through the chemo so I can't do anything, but then also any money we had started to set aside to rebuild our life again after the transplant to further our careers, now
that's
all being
gone.
Swallowed up, by everything with the cancer. And I feel doubly guilty, I think. That's the other thing that I've felt, is not only the fact that, crap, I have cancer, but also then, crap, I'm taking money away that would have been for things for us to further our careers. And that's something that I feel guilty about every day. But at the same time, I realized, just like we went through with your kidney transplant, obviously our lives come first. And so it's just, you know, we have to figure out how to save our own life, because then we don't have a career beside that anyway. Even if, you know, if we die, we don't have a career either. So we got to save ourselves first.
Well, but I think also the, you know, for us, it's the double hit of having a medical crisis, as well as that being a severe financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think more people experience that than we really realize, because people, you know, people with even good jobs right now are struggling if they have a medical crisis.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that, you know, I have been, you know, with all of my latest music projects, I've been able to be unbelievably frugal. I mean, look at how many free instruments have fallen into my hands in the last, you know, several years. And I would have never thought to go to eBay to buy musical equipment, but necessity was the driver of that. I couldn't just go down to the local music store and buy brand new equipment.
Right.
I just had to find something that was going to work. And I even designed my most recent music project more or less around what I already owned, so that I could put something out there that was interesting and just make it happen.
Well, it's funny. I remember when we were meeting with UCSF for the transplant, and when we first told them, or actually when they were first talking to me as a donor and asked me what I did for a living, and I said, I'm an artist. And they said, oh, so you're self-employed. Yes, okay. So then they immediately started me talking about financial help. And thank goodness they did. They were able to give me a good grant and all that other thing that helped out with some of the costs. But the other thing that I always cling to, and I had repeated before with other friends that are also in the creative industries, is that UCSF, they said, well, you know, we've always, when we've worked with people who are individually employed, who are artists, creative people, we've always been amazed at how resourceful they are and that somehow they always make it happen and make it work. And I thought, yeah, that is true. I mean, we always, because I think as needed by nature, when you're an artist of any type, you have to be resourceful to survive because you can't, nobody can afford to get, unless you're already wealthy to begin with, you can't afford to get all the great equipment and supplies that you would love to have or even have a big studio or anything like that because you just can't afford it. And so you have to be resourceful in the first place. I mean, my studio is in my house just like yours is because we can't afford to have a separate facility for that.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, in the end, I'm kind of appreciative that it's in our house because I know that at any moment I can get up and just walk across the hall and go into my studio and work. And I've liked that previously anyway, because then when we had our dogs, they could just come in and visit and I was there and, you know, there's no major huge commute, you know, and if I wanted to work until 5 a.m. in the morning, I could go to sleep after that. And, or if I woke up in the middle of the night with an idea, I could just walk right over to my studio and work. And I appreciated that. And so even that's maybe not the best situation. It'd be great to have a big studio somewhere and both of us. I think it ends up being more convenient for us to have it at home. And then the thing is, because we're both without, you know, it's just the two of us in our house without kids, most of our house is just our studios. And then we have our bedroom and our bathroom and our kitchen, and that's it. Yeah. And there's no problem with that because, you know,
the whole house is a workspace.
Yeah, the whole house is our working studio. And so at least then we have, you know, a good place to continue to work. But, you know, the other thing that I was thinking about is that in between, sandwiched both between the transplant and between now my cancer, we both lost our moms.
Yeah.
And that was really an interesting thing because I don't feel like I've really gotten to grieve about my mom yet because it was so soon after, like a couple of weeks later, that I found out I had cancer. And so I didn't really get a chance to even just sit with the fact that, oh, gee, my mom is gone now and what all that means. You know, it's just, it's been a roller coaster because I went through the shock of when she passed, being there with her and everything, and then going through and helping my family put the funeral together and all that happening. And then right afterwards, finding out I had cancer. So it's, I don't know if there's going to be at some point in time in the future that when I finally get past this round that I'll just crumble and realize that, you know, so much has changed in the last year. How about you with your mom?
Well, again, I think I had a head start on you because my mom being who she was, I really never had her as a mom. You know, she was off practicing her dalliances with other men my whole life. And so she was never really home. She was never really a mom. And when she tried to be a mom, it was more about maintaining some kind of narcissistic control over her son. And so, and you know that for a long time, I tried to somehow salvage that and turn her into a mom, and it was never going to happen. But, you know, again, I kind of got a head start on her, on you, when, you know, the day of the surgery, you were in the operating room long, and I was starting to panic. And our friends that were with me were comforting me, and my mother tried to use that opportunity to manipulate the situation into finding out how she could take control of that situation and make it all about her. And that was the day she was dead to me.
That was the moment it snapped in your brain.
That was the moment it snapped in my brain that she had no other interest in life than controlling everybody and everything, and that she was simply incapable of being a nurturing person of any kind. It just wasn't in her. And I had to accept that it just wasn't in her. It wasn't who she was. And so any real grieving I did was...
then?
Really, yeah. About, a good year and a half before she died.
Yeah.
You know. And then, of course, she died because of her own vanity.
Right.
So, and it's... the loss happened a long before she was actually gone. And so by the time she actually died, I had already forgiven her, let it go. And so when it came time to do her funeral, I had no problem bringing the organ in and playing beautiful music for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I still think it was interesting that your aunt, her sister... the eulogy she put together. This is the thing she would have said.
The thing she would have said.
Because she never did say any of those things. She never did actually say that she appreciated or thanked anybody or appreciated what anyone did for her. You know, she was always just on the mode of give me, give me, give me, give me, give me. And I deserve it, I deserve it, I deserve it. And so she never stopped to actually thank anybody or think that they deserved thanking.
Right.
And so I thought that was just really clever how your aunt, her own sister, put together, this is what she would have said. And I thought, wow, that's interesting.
Well, of course, by the time she died at 78, and by that time, everybody around her knew who and what she was.
That was also a revelation because, again, I think you and I were living in a bubble thinking that, were we the only ones who recognizing how awful she is? And then when the story started coming in when she was in the hospital, like, wow, okay, I guess she is... more obvious to other people.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a relief, actually, because I really thought I was just thinking bad about her, and I didn't want to be the only person thinking that. And again, a lot of that was based off of my personal observations, but then also things that you told me from over the years of ways that she treated you. And so it made it very difficult to relate to her.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I started hearing those stories from other people that were even closer to her, I thought, okay, I'm not stupid and weird.
No.
This is real. She is this person that is not a good person. So
people like that can only fool others for a short period of time. That's why she always had a constant parade of new people in her life.
That is true.
And she always had to have, complete control over the people close to her because that's the only way she really felt right about herself. She had to be in charge. And of course, she wanted so badly to be in charge of everything around the kidney transplant.
Yeah.
And the fact was, even if she had been the type of person that could have done well with that situation, it still would have been inappropriate because she was too old and she was partially handicapped at that point
yeah.
and was not going to be able to do what was necessary.
UCSF themselves told us that you cannot have family
your
caregivers. They said that's a rule and policy that you do not have actual family members be caretakers because they're too emotionally involved and they can't make decisions, based on fact.
She thought I was lying when I told her.
I'm sure she did. And so
I wouldn't be surprised if she called UCSF and asked about it.
Thank goodness they had that policy. But so, yeah. And so then when we were putting that list together of everybody, and thank God again, I have to say again, over and over, for me, that whole situation, part of the reason why it felt like everything was running so smoothly is because we were so fortunate with all the friends that we had that came forward immediately and said they wanted to help us out. And so when we had to do that list of who our caretakers were going to be, and that was a long list because they wanted one person only or two people for driving, two people for caretaking, two people for this, two people for that, running errands, all the things. They want to make sure that you're going to be well taken care of because they don't want to perform a transplant and then have it go bad because you haven't gotten the care. So when we had to compile that list, but everybody had already come forward, all of our friends saying they wanted to be a part, I was like, oh, okay, well, now I can look at this person. And I just called them and say, hey, would you be willing to do this for me and Tony? And they said, yeah, absolutely. And so it was really quite easy to put that list together. And then when it came to specifically caretakers, two things, not even realizing that some of our closest friends were professionals in the field until we asked them that question. And so then we were able to put down that here we have somebody who's going to be a caretaker that's a certified caretaker and somebody who's a certified social worker. And here's, you know, and then our top two caretakers that took care of us right after the transplant were Ellen and April Langstrat, who had just gone through that same procedure themselves only a few years earlier. So it was just amazing that they were able to be there for us and they knew exactly what we were going through. They were able to sense what we needed and everything. And so I think I know it did, because when UCSF called me, I said, well, they were really impressed with our list. And they actually, of course, call everybody individually and ask them, are you absolutely ready to do this? And everybody said, yeah, we're definitely set. So they were really pleased with our caregiver group of friends. And again, now, of course, as I'm going through this ordeal with cancer, our friends are coming forward again. And really, you know, helping out with emotional support and financial support, giving to our GoFundMe campaign and giving to, you know, doing the fundraisers again and stuff like that. So I'm so grateful for all of that. I think that might be the only thing that's kind of keeping me together at this moment. But it's just amazing. I think especially in the artistic community, you really have fellow creatives that understand how difficult it is to get through things like this. And they pull forward. And again, funny thing about, you know, putting together fundraisers, all of our friends are instant performers. You know, they are people who are in the theater and singers and musicians and stuff. So it's not like we have to suddenly find people who can do this. Yeah. These are people who all our friends already do this to begin with. So yeah. It's amazing.
A lot of entertainer friends, which is cool. But I think that the thing in the last 3-4 months since December, when we found out that you did have lymphoma, and I guess the thing that worries me is how hard this has hit you. That it really, I don't know how I want to say this, because I know you are a very, very strong person. But at the same time, I've never seen you break down as hard as you have with this.
Now, like I said, it's pulling a rug out from under me. Yeah. Any thought I had of what I was before this is gone. Now, I'm still an artist. I still want to be involved in art, and I still want to enjoy life, but there's that overshadowing right now of the fact that my life is never the same. And the constant worry of, is this going to come back? Every time I have to go through the blood tests and PET scans in the future now, I'm going to be laying on the table wondering, oh my God, please no cancer, please no cancer. And there's always that fear. You know, it was never real as it is now. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like I said, the way I described it from the last PET scan I just did Tuesday this week, that on the table, it's just all these images in my head flooding in of all the movies you've ever seen of cancer patients, and realizing that I'm living it.
Well, that's why Delilah said no cancer movies for
a while. I haven't watched any. Our friend Delilah Kit Barhat and McDonald, yes. And I haven't watched any films, but we had watched them previously, because there's that one that you particularly love, The 50-50, and I've watched it with you so many times because you like to watch it so often. And now, of course, those images come into my head while you're laying there having to be quiet and still in the PET scan machine. And so, you know, it's that kind of thing of, now I'm living that. And And now I don't have that assurance of, gee, I'm taking care of myself, eating well and exercising, and I'm healthy. Not anymore, even though I was doing those things. And now I have cancer, and I'm hoping to get through this first bout, but how soon or when will it come back again? And that's the dark cloud that I have to get used to now and hopefully let it fade into the background so I'm not thinking about it constantly. I think, you know, honestly, it is very hard because it's right now. Mm-hmm. It's my present right now. But I'm hoping that once I get past this and am in remission, that as the years go by and as my hair grows back, as my taste buds come back, all the things come back, that maybe it'll go further and further back into my mind so I'm not thinking about it every day. And I only have to think about it when I have to go in for tests or something, but I don't know yet. It is so new, you know, and yeah. I'm still grappling that right now.
Well, of course, the only thing I can say is from my own experience is that when I first got the kidney, because they put it down around my belt line,
mm-hmm.
and I really can't wear belts anymore. And so they didn't tell me that because I didn't know. And
plus, it's such a minor thing. They don't want to tell you about that.
Yeah, they don't tell you everything. But, you know, that made me just fiercely aware, oh, there's somebody else's kidney in my belly mm-hmm. keeping me alive. And at any moment, something could go wrong. And I've met people, of course, who have had that exact thing happen to them. I've met several people that have 3 kidney transplants because the first 2 failed within a year. And then, of course, we've met a lot of people that have had them for 10, 15, 20, 30 years.
You never know.
It felt like a dark cloud for a long time, for about the first 6 months. It really felt like a dark cloud.
So then you know what I'm feeling.
I know what you're feeling. I know absolutely what you're feeling. But it doesn't have to be a dark cloud. It can, you know, because there's an old saying, no news is good news, right? And I know that sounds flippant and trite, but
I've said it many times myself.
But it's true. And for me, you know, if I wake up and I'm not feeling pain on the kidney site, the scar hasn't become all inflamed, all the things that they tell you that might happen if it's going to be rejected or if I'm not getting ill. And then I see my blood test results, which are every 3 months, and I always go, what's the GFR?
Mm-hmm.
And if that's good, then I know I'm okay. And I'm okay right now.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, that's all we got right now.
Well, the thing is, again, it's just adjusting to the new normal.
Yep.
And not having had any health problems up until now, and now I have a whole host of them, because it's not just the cancer, it's also the liver having problems and other things.
Well, you do everything big.
Then
when
it's,
you decide to become a full-time artist, you quit your job.
Yeah.
Even though we really weren't in a financial place to do it.
But see, those were all fun things to do.
But I said, go ahead, we'll figure it out. And then your first surgery ever was a nephrectomy to donate a kidney.
Right.
And yep. You didn't just give it to me. You had to donate into the larger exchange pool so that more lives could be saved.
Well, I was your match.
You were my match.
But
you could have just given me a kidney.
But I appreciated that they told us ahead of time about the paired exchange, because then that's why I said, well, is there still a chance that you could get a better kidney that way? And they said, yeah, even closer than mine. So that's why we went with that.
Sure.
But, and I, again, those were all pluses. I felt like, you know, I was doing something good in the world. It was, here, a healthy person, I'm donating a kidney that not only gets to help you get a kidney, but then ends up helping all these other people get kidneys, too. That was all great. So even though I was facing surgery, a major surgery, it was not even a concern, because I'm thinking, I'm doing something good. And even if I die on the table, I'm doing something good. But now,
it's hard to see surviving cancer as something good. Because all indicators are you're going to survive this.
I don't think it's the surviving part that's not the good thing. It's just that the fact that now I'm a cancer patient.
Mm-hmm.
I forever will be somebody who had cancer. I might not ever be able to donate ever again because I have cancer. And because I'm always going to be somebody who is somebody who had cancer. You know, you walk through those forms that they have you fill out every time you go to any doctor, and it's like, have you ever had this? Have you ever had that? Nope, 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 nope. Now I've got a whole bunch of things I have to mark.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that, again, it's the relinquishing of what I was before, which was the healthy person that seemed to be more carefree about life because I didn't have any major health issues. And now that I do, and forevermore have that over my head, it's no longer a carefree existence. It's no longer a situation where I feel like I'm the healthy person that can help other people. Hmm. Now I'm also a sick person. And that's the hardest thing to give up, is that no longer feeling like I can just contribute to the world. Now I'm part of a burden. I'm somebody who also has problems that is draining the system and causing issues. And, you know, I'm just glad that we didn't have any kids for so many reasons previously, but even more now, because both with us having our health issues, those would have been things that would have been passed on to the kids.
Yeah, possibly.
And so we'll forever have dogs and fish, which is okay.
Well, but I mean, I think I'll finish that. Okay. I think that because you were a donor and you donated in the biggest way possible, you paid your dues. You're not a burden. You paid for it.
Thanks.